Welcome to the GRF On The Go podcast. The subject matter experts at GRF CPAs and Advisors created this podcast to offer insights on current topics, as well as new ideas and best practices that your team can apply today. This podcast was originally presented as a live webinar. CPE information provided during the podcast is no longer valid, but if you're interested in watching the video version of this session or accessing the slide deck, visit our website at grfcpa.com/events. Enjoy the episode and remember to subscribe for future content.
Okay, well, very good morning to everyone. I want to welcome you all to our webinar today, Future-Proofing Nonprofits and Managing Risks for Long-Term Success. My name is Christian Spencer. I am a partner here at GRF and in our audit and assurance practice. And I am joined alongside today by my colleague, Melissa Musser, and I am happy to be with her and presenting, and we thank you all for joining us today. We have a lot of great information to get to, particularly I think that'll be relevant in terms of today's environment. I want to cover a couple of housekeeping items first, though. There is one CPE credit available for today's event. So at the conclusion of this presentation, there will be a short survey automatically appearing. If you complete that, that will then spark the receipt of a one CPE certificate, and you can utilize that to stay compliant with your CPE. There will also be a series of very, very simple polling questions throughout the seminar, just to make sure you're engaged and listening as required when we do this in order to issue CPE. One final note, I just want to indicate that we have a lot of great information today to provide to you, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention that this is not financial or legal advice. Neither Melissa nor I are attorneys. So we are simply just doing what we do best and what we love to do, which is disseminate information based upon client experiences, based upon what we see in the marketplace, and really just providing some information for educational purposes. So just remember, this is not financial or legal advice. Just a little bit about GRF. We are based out of Bethesda, Maryland. We serve clients both in the DMV area, throughout the country, and throughout the world. Our general focus is on nonprofit organizations as well as government contracting, but we also work in the for-profit space and a number of other organizations as well. But again, our principal space are working with nonprofit organizations. We have been in operations for nearly four decades or over four decades, and we will be celebrating our 45th anniversary in the coming year. So as you can see on the next slide, again, we do have a number of different areas that we cover, audit assurance and a litany of other service areas that we do provide to organizations. So certainly feel free to reach out to us if there are any of these items that we certainly can assist you with. We'd love to dialogue and have a discussion with you. Again, you can see here our highlights and objectives today are fairly straightforward. I'm going to kick it over to Melissa in just a few moments. We're going to talk a little bit about the importance of nonprofits, really understanding risk and how they handle risk and how they assess risk, certain techniques for identifying and managing risks. And then I will take over the presentation after Melissa, and we'll kind of parlay some of what she talks about in terms of enterprise risks and some of these identified risks. And really, how do you correlate that to your operating reserves? So we'll kind of bridge that discussion, and then we'll have some kind of conclusions and things along those lines. So again, we're happy to have you here today, and I'll kick it over to Melissa, who will take it from here.
Great. Thank you. Great job, Christian. My name is Melissa Musser. I am partner and director of our firm's Risk and Advisory Services. And, we 7 years ago, we were, you know, experiencing a lot of clients asking about enterprise risk management, risk management, and they seem to be frustrated with some of the services they may have gotten from other organizations, other service providers. And what we found was that when looking for risk management, it really wasn't tailored to the industry. And we really wanted to do something about that. I'm very passionate about enterprise risk management. We wanted to find something that was a good fit for this industry. So we partnered with NC State. So we just had our sixth event. We're very proud of this partnership that we have. So, feel free to join. I mean, feel free to access our website. We have a really good ERM resources page. It's got lots of guides and tools and events. And just really wanted to point that out to you all that we do have that service for you. So just to get kicked off, we're going to be talking a little bit about understanding the need for better risk oversight. And again, that is why we started this 6 years ago. So the world is crazy, and it's been kind of this way. The velocity of risks are increasing. There's always been a lot of risk, but the speed at which they come at you are getting are getting very, very fast. And another thing is that we're finding is that, if I was to come and come to your organization and meet with you, maybe interview some folks, and if I was to interview your management team and I ask you, what's your strategic objectives for the year or maybe the next 3 years? And everybody would really, for the most part, be on the same page, right? I mean, you got a strategic plan, the strategy, everybody knows the strategy, or if I was to meet with your board. Conversely, if I'm to then ask, okay, well, what do you see as the organization's top, let's say, three risks? And you almost never get everyone on the same page. And that's actually a really big problem because your biggest risks likely affect your strategy and how you're going to achieve that. It's also going to likely affect your budget dollars. Let's say if it's labor and that's a staffing crisis, well then wouldn't you see more budget dollars going towards staffing? Or if it's cyber, wouldn't I expect to see some investment there? And a lot of times, that's not really connected. And it's because there's not this consensus. And sometimes it's just the loudest person in the room. There's not a methodology. So we're going to talk about that today. How do you even come up with a methodology? And that's really kind of what enterprise risk management is. And another thing is just really even defining what significant is. And like I said, we partner with NC State. And so this was a cool slide from one of the presentations before. And I really like this. And so oftentimes they'll do surveys of different different organizations, folks with different titles within the organization, just to kind of gauge their insight onto risk. And so this is just an example of an exercise where different C-suite folks or board members were asked, what is significant to your organization? Like, what's the significant risk? And of course, the CIOs, the chief technology officer, says there's 17 huge risks. And they're not wrong. Cyber is number one. CFO says one, CEO says 13, board members say zero. And it makes you pause, like, okay, why is this? Is it that board members aren't getting the information they need, or is risk not being discussed at the board level? And that's certainly possible. Or maybe they don't think in terms of risk, they think in terms of strategy. Or maybe they're right in the sense that, no, we're on course, nothing is really significant. And maybe boards are defining significant differently than everyone else. And that's a big deal too, because we really need to be using the same taxonomy, the same language, which is why an ERM playbook or an ERM policy and procedure is such a good idea, so that when we say something significant, everybody's really on the same page as to what that actually means. Significant, does that mean, our systems go down for 3 days? Is it national media attention? Like, what is significant? Another thing with enterprise risk management is a lot of times folks will conflate the words, risk management with enterprise risk management. Maybe they were a risk manager before, or they had risk management, and now they just start using the title enterprise risk management, when in fact, they're still just doing traditional risk management. It's kind of a buzzword. Maybe not everyone completely understands it. So we're going to kind of talk about that today. So now traditional risk management is still going to exist. IT is likely still going to have their own little risk registers. HR will. Finance certainly will. All these different folks are going to have the risks that they track, right? But you'll notice that there's a lack of coordination, whether it's in, hey, do we all have these same risks? How is this one risk affecting all of us? Or how are we handling the remediation of these risks? Is there something better that we should be doing? And then also, how are we communicating that up to executive leadership and then the board? And how do we know what is the most significant and how it's affecting our strategy? And so you can see why ERM is kind of a layer over top that really benefits connecting all these dots. So when you hear enterprise risk management helps holistically evaluate risks, or it helps with the culture of the organization. This is really what they're getting at. So here's another visual. So enterprise risk management is really at the intersection of traditional risk management and your strategy and objectives. Now, there are frameworks out there if you wanted to learn more. So there's the COSO ERM framework that's out there. It was revamped in 2019 because what they found is that folks that had enterprise risk management still had some failures. You know, we always use the Blockbuster example, such a good example, because they had enterprise risk management, but they didn't see the risk within their strategy. Right. And so that's really important, is to, you have to be looking through the lens of strategy. So the ERM framework was updated in 2019 to put more emphasis on that, basically saying if strategy isn't at the center of your risk management, you're doing it wrong. So folks that maybe have had ERM for a long time before that time period, they may be having a hard time getting out of the rut of that. Folks that haven't implemented ERM or implementing it now, you guys kind of have an advantage because you can set up your process and your program a little bit more strategy centered. Here's another cool graphic from NC State. I really love the way this is presented here. And this is just another way of looking at things. There's no right or wrong way to look at it. But here you can see that we're looking at it through the lens of our strategy. Strategic Initiative 1 has a lot of risks, and we may need to relook at that strategy. And that's the cool part about ERM, is that it is really the inverse relationship of strategic planning. So when you're doing your strategy, you know, you may really want to have already done your ERM in advance of that, or maybe it's running parallel, or somehow these processes are kind of running at the same time. And it depends on how often you update your strategic plan. But you can see, once you look at your risks, it's like, maybe we need to divert our strategy here on initiative one. Risk number four, maybe just looking at it on its own, you know, okay, but now that I see it's affecting all our initiatives, now I realize that impact for risk number four is significant, and we really need to look at this. So you can see how if this was just in a silo, we might not have had that information, and bringing it all together helps us make better informed decisions, because we don't have unlimited budget dollars. We don't have unlimited time during a day. We need to focus on the things that matter the most. And this is a methodology to help us get there. We want to work smarter, not harder. So one of the ways to connect the dots, if you remember the silos, is to form a risk council, a management level risk committee, right? And so this is where the magic starts to happen. Now, you can still have a risk manager, an enterprise risk manager, a chief risk officer. We're still going to see that. And that individual could serve as the chair of the risk council. But we can't just have one individual own risk. That has been proven to not be successful. ERM means everyone's a risk manager, but we got to break down the silos. Another problem with just having one person own it is when that person leaves, the whole program collapses on itself. And we've seen that. So a risk council is a really excellent way to bring it all together. And, you know, we can go more into what all that would entail. It really kind of depends on the context of your organization. But really bringing it all together, kind of working to get that consensus on the likelihood and impact of those top risks, working on the handling plans, and then, you know, passing that information up to executive leadership, getting feedback down, and also reporting out to the board of directors or the audit committee. And you'll notice the arrows are going up and down from the project level, staff level, volunteer level, and that's where risks can be escalated. So just to pivot slightly, so this is the state of risk oversight. This is a survey that NC State does every year that I really like this survey. And I think it helps make a good point. And I like that they break out between, you know, banking, because banking has ERM, but it's so much different. And same with the public company. And I love that they break this out for not-for-profit organizations. So I always like bringing this to your attention. The link was in the previous slide, but you can always just look it up online if you want to look more at it. But there's a few things I wanted to bring to your attention. Now, it is the board's responsibility for risk oversight. So it is very important that somehow you're coming up with maybe the top risks to be presenting to your board, right? And you need to be making sure that's happening and it's being discussed in the minutes. You know, God forbid there's some kind of cyber attack or some kind of big issue that you really should have known about. And you look back and you say, gosh, we didn't even talk about this at the board meetings. There's nothing in the minutes. So it's really important. So if you're on the board and if your organization isn't reporting out to you on risk, I would urge you to start asking. A lot of times organizations are implementing ERM either because people within the organization are tired of running around frantically and they want more organization, or the boards are like, listen, I am not getting the information I need. Let's formalize this. So if for nonprofits, the board usually delegates this to the audit committee. We're seeing about 60% of the time. So you might want to look at your audit committee charter, see what it says in there. Maybe you need to update it. Maybe it's already in there that this committee is responsible for risk oversight. It's kind of standard language, but you always want to take a look at that. But about 60% put it in this committee. Now, how often are risks presented? At least annually, please make sure that's being done. You need to do a risk assessment annually anyway, because how else are you going to update your policies and procedures for the new environment? So that's a minimum. I'd say that's a COSO, internal control standard. So every year you look at how the process has changed, you make updates to your policies. From an enterprise risk perspective, you should be doing it at least annually and reporting out to your board. We're seeing quarterly also be pretty common, and that's kind of what I would suggest as well. Now, how many risks are reported? So I think this is a good one. I still think, five is more than enough, but you'll see between 10 and 19, anything more than 20 risks is just overkill. That the board should not be getting that level of information. And a lot of times, the folks could be doing maybe a better job of grouping risks into risk themes so that these aren't all separate. And sometimes you'll see that when there's all these silos and risks are coming together, they're not really organized very well in a cohesive way. And that's where the risk council can kind of all come together and go, this is really like a category of a risk, or this or not. And let's present this in general to the board. Less than 23 is even fine, just somewhere in that area, report out to your board. And then how often are these risk council meetings? And you'll see quarterly is sufficient. A lot of times you'll probably want to meet in advance of the board meeting if you're going to be presenting risk information to the board, but at a minimum quarterly, even if you're only reporting to the board annually, just to make sure that those handling plans are being addressed. And so the next time you meet to the board, you can say, okay, this is how this was addressed, and here are some new emerging risks that are being presented. All right, looks like we're going to pause here for a very simple polling question. Are you still listening? All right. Hopefully you're still listening. I talk very fast. I'm hopefully keeping you engaged. So every year, for the past several years, we've been doing a top risk report for nonprofits and associations. I'm really proud that we do this. And Amy Weirs is really great job. If you don't know her, but she's part of our EIRM team. She did a really good job pulling all this together for us, as well as Tom Brown. And so what we do is we go and we look in the crystal ball, but we also, Google the internet and there's all these other organizations that do these really fantastic top risk reports, and we don't want to compete with them. So, but what we do is what we have done is we've made an appendix, and in the appendix, it lists so many of these top risk reports. So it's really your one-stop shop for all things risks. You can get our report where we kind of synthesize this into the context of nonprofits and associations. But down below, you'll be able to see more detail on where we're getting this risk information from, all these other great resources. And this came out about a month ago, I believe. And it is on our website. So the top ones, obviously, geopolitical risk. We forecasted this last year. There were more elections going on in the entire world than really ever. I think over 50% of the world was having some sort of an election. And man, the impact has been huge, especially here in the United States. As you know, I don't need to go into that, but that's the number one risk that we're seeing. Well, technically, these are really in any kind of order. But it definitely seems to be the most urgent risk. Cybersecurity as well, it's the reigning champion of risk. So please be sure you have an information security policy. Even if you outsource your IT, I think there's some real basic things that you really need to be doing. Feel free to see me if you want to learn more about that. We actually do tons of webinars on cybersecurity, but then also significant operation disruption. Just business continuity, whether that's an individual, a natural disaster, all kinds of things here, but those are the top three things to focus on. I would expect to see them in your risk register or something that you're probably going to be reporting out to the board. Now, to figure out what your top risks are, obviously you got to understand your context, right? So, you know, yeah, it could be those three things, but you know, where are you located? What's your structure? Like how many, you know, what kind of systems do you use? Are you still on-prem? Do you need to move to the cloud? I mean, it's, you know, everyone's unique. So you really can't, even if it's two really similar organizations, your risks are going to be unique. So you got to take the time to develop and understand the context. And again, the risk council is really going to help inform that. A lot of different ways to get to that risk. Again, my favorite is just objectives based. What's our strategy? What are the risks to us achieving that strategy? And even going through and interviewing different people within the organization, like interviewing HR. All right, you know, here's the organization's goals and objectives. I'm assuming your goals and objectives have trickled down from that. Hopefully, if not, that's probably your first risk, right? Is that folks don't even know what our goals and objectives are. But if it trickles down to HR and then I'm talking with them and I say, okay, well, what are the biggest risks of you achieving your specific goals and objectives? And, you know, that's where they could share, well, I don't have the technology or we're not paying our people enough. Or, okay, so that's risk information that we need to gather that affects our strategy that we might not have gathered otherwise, or it may not have made it to the level that it needs to get communicated, to get changed, right? So that's one of my favorite ways because it's a little different. But then there's, of course, past events, doing surveys. These are things that GRF can help with. We help do anonymous surveys, process flow, scenario. Scenario planning's been really, you know, a big one, especially for disasters. Cybersecurity, just making sure you're ready. Current events is a really big example right now with the administration. And then just facilitated workshops and interviews. Maybe you have your ERM in place and every year you annually do some kind of workshop to do a refresh. You don't have to boil the ocean. These are just a lot of different examples. All that forms a risk inventory. You can use Excel. You don't have to get some big GRC platform. Here's just a really simple example. And you can just use high, medium, and low for your scales and then work to define that over time. Like I was talking about, what does significant mean? You're going to want to have an ERM playbook that defines that. But if you don't have that yet and you want to get started, high, medium, and low is fine. Don't kill yourself. Just get started. But ultimately, you'll take the likelihood times impact equals the risk level, and the risk event are kind of the three that I just discussed in our nonprofit top risks. So, you know, this is just kind of an example. Anything that's high, you're going to want a handling plan for, or medium, you know, you'll want to monitor, kind of be ready. Anything low, you just kind of, it's lower priority. You might not need to track it. Maybe just assign someone to monitor it. This can also turn into kind of nice visuals and heat maps and all kinds of different stuff. But at the very minimum, this is just kind of how you can divide it all out. And you could, and if it's in Excel, you could sort it. You know, you can come up with a risk category, kind of link together, you know, risk themes, you know, like, oh, okay, these are all IT related risks. Or maybe you can go ahead and assign an owner and you say, you know what, these are all risks related to, let's say the chief technology officer, or maybe these are all just legal risks and we'll assign the owner to legal, and all kinds of different ways to do that or to slice and dice it. Again, it's an art, not a science. It just depends on works best for your context. This is just an easy way to get started. So for those top risks, those high level risks, we're gonna wanna create handling plans. Now a handling plan doesn't mean you have to do something, right? You'll wanna have an executive owner. And that executive risk owner needs to be high enough in the organization to make things happen, right? To be responsible. Someone is going to be sitting on the risk council likely. And then that person can then delegate to other folks that could be doing other things, maybe making sure there's proper insurance or, you know, different things that they could be doing. And as well as like a timeline and when they're going to report back and all these great things. And also list maybe interrelated risks. So handling plans, they can always look different. Here's an example. We have all kinds of different templates that we use that make the most sense for our clients. But I would also note, let's say, I always like to beat up on technology folks. Let's say your chief technology officer is the owner of cyber risk, which totally makes sense. And they should have a handling plan and they should be working on it and they should be reporting it out. I still strongly suggest that the risk council have the authority to possibly hire someone else, or maybe it's the board or the audit committee, to get assurance on that risk. It's too big of a risk to have the person that owns it not to double check what they're saying. Like, oh, everything's great. Okay, well, is it? I want to see, you know, I want some independent assurance over that, whether it's an internal audit or a full-blown SOC audit or cybersecurity audit. Those are just examples. I would still suggest independent assurance if it's a major top risk. All right, we're going to pause again. Are you still listening? All right, I am going to be turning it over to Christian.
Okay, thank you very much, Melissa. So what we're going to do next is we're going to sort of bridge the gap here between what Melissa was discussing in terms of ERM, talk a little bit more about ERM, and then move into how do you develop really a reserve policy that addresses the risks identified in ERM. And we're going to talk about one common approach. And you'll see on the slide here to the right, the concept that we present here, and I should mention this is just one of many concepts that we've run across over the course of working with many different nonprofits, is try to target more your reserves for specific risks and opportunities versus just simply saying, my strategy is to have 9 months of operating expenses. Because what we have found in the course of working with a number of organizations is, continuing to sock away reserves, if you're fortunate enough to have them, for a sort of broad-based risk or opportunity assessment is not always a defensible position to members and constituents. Versus when you go through an exercise and a process, like we'll give you an example in a few minutes, of specifically identifying risks, specifically identifying opportunities, attempting to establish the likelihood of these coming to actuality and the potential financial impact, and framing that around a reserve model, that's a much more defensible position with your funders, with your members, with your constituents. So start to think maybe a little bit about that as one model, more of a targeted model versus simply kind of a shot in the dark and in a very broad-based model. So again, one of the items that Melissa talked about, and I found her slide very striking on the, it was a sort of an Excel chart that across that horizontal row had strategic initiatives, and then down the vertical axis had risks. And if you look at, this is kind of just another way of framing that here, right at the top is the strategic plan. And for an organization, everything should be revolving around your strategic plan that has been engaged and adopted by your organization's governance. And then, so, you know, I kind of think of this funnel more as a triangle where you flip it around, and the strategic plan is really the base of everything you're doing. You're building off of that. Next would be your operational plan. How are you going to deploy the resources to support your strategic plan? The next level would be the financial plan. Again, as we'll show in a few minutes, kind of quantifying your risks and opportunities and potentially trying to prognosticate some associated costs with that to execute upon these strategic initiatives. And then, of course, like everything, there has to be some reserve policy around the accessibility and availability of your funds. And really, that reserve policy oftentimes is divided into you know, a short-term policy on initiatives that may be within whatever you deem to be short-term, 12 to 18 months, and a long-term policy on longer-term risks and objectives. Because you're going to want to stratify and sort of strategize your investment policy to sort of mirror that risk policy. And again, we're not investment advisors, but I would argue that if you have a long-term risk or opportunity that's further out, that's going to be a different investment policy perhaps than a short-term risk or policy. So again, this is just sort of taking these items and laying them out in a systematic approach. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, really the general idea is to take your scenarios and your risks and opportunities. And I do want to pause there for a minute because we have been focusing mainly on risks. But when you look at a reserve policy and you attempt to line it up with your enterprise risk model, what we have oftentimes found is one thing that's sort of left by the wayside are opportunities. And as any growing organization that is looking to continue to provide value to its members and constituents, it's a natural course of action to be looking at risks. But you should also really be looking at opportunities as well. How can we provide that value-added opportunity to our member or constituent? What initiatives down the road might we want to embark upon that would require a sum of money or some element of funding to meet that value proposition? So as we go through these slides, you'll see that I'm going to refer to not just risks, but also opportunities as well. Again, so the general idea here is, and you can see in the yellow items are not filled in with numbers because each organization is going to be a little bit different as to what you define as a high, medium, or low likelihood, or a high, medium, or low magnitude. So again, you look at your identified risks and opportunities. And perhaps one organization's likelihood of high would be somewhere within the next 5+ years, medium maybe 3 to 5, low maybe less than 3. And then you look at magnitude, and of course, that's got to be scaled based upon the budget size of the organization. So again, what you're trying to do here is you're looking at each risk and opportunity. You're assigning a likelihood, you're assigning a magnitude, and then that's going to really drive how this sort of plays into your overall reserve model. So let's just for a moment talk a little bit about defining reserves because the term is thrown around quite a bit. And I'll give you what in terms of the context of this presentation and what we commonly see as the calculation and definition. So kind of working from left to right, you see on the left-hand side a simple statement of financial position for an organization, $5 million in assets, $1.2 million in liabilities, $3.8 million in net assets. So we've got a balanced statement of financial position here. If you move over to the right-hand side of the slide, you'll see the reserve calculation. So we are taking net assets or essentially the equity of the organization. And we're backing out two items. First, we're going to be backing out those net assets with donor restrictions because, as we all know in the nonprofit space, these amounts come with a tag or a restriction for a particular purpose. So, in theory, they are not really available to be used for any kind of contingency or any kind of growth opportunity outside of the donor-imposed restriction. So, we generally take those out. And then in this example, we're going to take out the property and equipment because that's really a non-liquid asset. And so we're looking at more liquid reserves here. So in this situation, we backed those two amounts out and we come to a reserve of $2.5 million. And then a lot of times we look at reserves in terms of a ratio. So here the ratio would be the numerator of 2.5 million over this example, the organization operating expenses are 6 million. So we have a reserve ratio of 42%. So in essence, the reserve can cover 42 cents of every dollar in terms of operating expenses. So again, this is just generally one way that we take a look at defining both the reserves as well as the reserve percent or ratio. So I did want to talk a little bit about benchmarking. And again, I'm just hitting on some topics that we hear a lot of out in the industry. Oftentimes organizations will say, well, I developed my reserve model based upon a benchmark of 9 months. Well, that is I would argue, a very good starting point. And certainly more information is better than less information when you're developing these reserves. But again, you're going to want to kind of understand that each organization, both their funding model, their size, and really the way that they earn their revenues is going to differ. So here is an example of a project that was done for an organization that is in the sort of architectural construction design space. And they went through and took a look at some similar organizations that were in that space. And again, all this information is publicly available, sort of vis-a-vis the 990 on GuideStar. And they did a simple calculation and they said, let me take the expenses, let me take the liquid reserve and come up with a ratio. So you can see a wide range of reserve ratios from 110% down to 12%. And again, it's going to be really predicated on how revenues are earned and the availability of cash. So oftentimes, what we see in terms of benchmarking is it's a good added point to have in sort of your support for your ratio and for your reserves, but it's not really the do-all end-all because of the differences in the various organizations. Another item that we get a lot of questions around is benchmarking, is in terms of how much is too much. I've heard many times we're a nonprofit organization. We really shouldn't be accumulating reserves. We shouldn't have a ton of investments and a ton of extra cash sitting around. It really should be deployed because we're tax exempt. And again, the IRS has never successfully challenged the accumulation of reserves for any a tax-exempt organization. And to my knowledge, the only requirement for expending money is the private endowments that are generally associated with a particular family or a particular enterprise that are required to have at least 5% of their value of their endowment disseminated for the furtherance of their exempt purpose on an annual basis. So again, the nature and the amount of reserves that you have is going to depend upon this process of going through an event identification around those risks and the risk appetite of the organization, certainly how you earn revenue, and we'll take a couple examples, take a look at that in a few minutes, and then also your accessibility and availability of cash. So let's take a look at a couple of different organizations that we've worked with over the years and what sort of their reserve model has been based upon how they earn their money and the nature of their operations. So this is what we call the individual reserve model. This is an individual membership organization in the education space with, I would argue, as indicated in the second bullet, a very, very diverse set of revenue earning streams. About 35% in membership, 20% in meetings, 16% in publications. So diverse in their revenue, $11 million in annual revenue. However, their dues are coming from 19,000 individual members at about $1.20 a member or $120 a member. So they're not having large sums of money come in at any one point in time, as would a membership model where there's a large amount of revenue coming in from a smaller population of large associations. So this organization took a position of maintaining a liquid reserve of 1 year of operating expenses, with the idea being that they want to position themselves to continue to provide services to their constituents in the event of an unexpected an event that would prohibit that or mitigate that. So their thought process is it mitigates the immediate need of staff reductions should something happen, and they have this money available in terms of needing that. So they maintain a healthy reserve. Another example here is the grants-based reserve model. And this was an organization that really took a look at their funding. And this is all, I should say, predates the events of the last couple of months. This organization took a look at this a number of years ago and said, about 3/4 of our funds come from federally funded or federal grants. We want to make sure that we have established another avenue of funding should we ever lose some of these grants. They were in a position really where they didn't have a lot of cash. They were relying upon lines of credit to pay the bills because it was a cost reimbursable situation until the funds came in, and were reimbursed by the government. So they launched a robust fundraising campaign sort of outside of the federal awards arena and really focused on looking at private grants, looking at educational type seminars, looking at other initiatives, including an annual gala. And a lot of this was supported by their board members, and their board members consisted of some fairly well-known, fairly well-connected individuals in the DMV region. And so leveraging this, sort of forward-facing effort by the board, they were able to start to diversify their revenue streams and become less and less dependent on the federal funds. They didn't move away from the federal funds, but just sought to diversify that. And then another example here is the exam-based model. Again, this is a 501c3 organization that runs a certification program. Again, a similar situation to one of the other ones we just took a look at, where there's a high volume of small dollar transactions of individual unconnected individuals that don't precipitate or really don't give rise to having a lot of cash on hand should you need something in a short order. So again, they move towards the model of 1 year's worth of operating expenses as well. And as I mentioned earlier, I want to talk just for a minute about geographic expansion or really looking at that value added opportunity to continue to provide that to your constituents. This was an example of a multi-entity association who ran a 501c6 as well as a C3, some for-profit entities. And they ran a domestic trade show that accounted for a significant part of their funds, but it only drew upon domestic membership, domestic companies. Using their reserves, they purchased a interest in a trade show in Europe that was running a similar show, but expanded their footprint to a broader international scale. And so they were able to retain the use of the minority member to help run the show because they found that, kind of having that local connectivity, boots on the ground in an international space, really helped to grow the show, helped to market the show. So again, this was just an example of using funds and using reserves to provide that value to your member and really grow your organization. Again, the current operating environment that we're in, and Melissa touched on many of these, consists of a lot of uncertainty. I mean, when we look at certainly the first two items we've all been experiencing over the course of the last several months, some of these other items certainly gave rise during the period of COVID and post-COVID in terms of meeting cancellations, reduction in attendance, decline in membership in certain organizations, as there is some element of consolidation in the industry where, depending upon how your membership is, organizations consolidating and buying each other out may result in an overall decrease in your revenue model. So again, you've got to consider that. Certainly office space considerations, and there's arguments made on that side of the debate either way on whether organizations are reducing that space because there's more remote and hybrid environment, or some organizations are having more in-office sort of mandates now, and they're looking for additional space. Melissa certainly mentioned cybersecurity and the ever-present risks that are constantly evolving in that arena. And I would say the availability of lines of credit is something that we've seen several times now, both in the current environment around some of the executive actions of the current administration, as well as during the early stages of COVID, where organizations didn't have an established line of credit available, and an event occurred and they ran looking for lines of credit, and banks were not always available or willing to lend them the line of credit once the event had occurred, because there was some concern either around collateral or some concern around the nature of the operation. So again, to each their own in this space, but you've got to at least pontificate and kind of consider the cost benefit of having that available line of credit always on standby, even if you're not going to use it, and it may cost you a couple $1,000s a year to have it available. But again, it's there, and it's a backdrop, and it's like an insurance policy should you ever need it. Then I would say the last two items there, succession planning, is something we're seeing a lot of too. There's a significant amount of baby boomers that are retiring, a significant amount of those in the workforce. I know I've seen it in the accounting and auditing space, a number of senior leaders looking to move on into retirement years. And what does that look like in a nonprofit in terms of your C-suite folks, and what steps have been taken place either to internally develop that next group of leaders, or if you're looking for an outside individual or individuals to take the helm, there's certainly generally costs with that in terms of headhunters and search firms. And then one final item here that we talk a lot about, and it's hard to really put a numeric dollar amount on this, but it's called the contagion factor. And, we have seen it to some degree in the last couple of months, whereas one event in the economy. It could be an economic event, it could be a socio-political event, it could be a environmental event occurs, and it has a metastasizing sort of cascading impact throughout the economy, and it triggers a lot of these other risks to take shape as well. And so doing the best that you can to think about that in terms of your organization. And again, some of these are going to be broad based across all organizations. Others are going to be more specific to your individual entity. So we have moved to our third and final polling question. So if you can just take a few moments to answer this, that would be great. Okie doke. We will move right along here. And so again, sort of taking into consideration everything we've had, I wanted to spend the last few minutes kind of walking through what a sample reserve policy or reserve study would look like. So again, for this organization, their current policy is to maintain $7.4 million in a long-term reserve to fund long-term projects, including new opportunities and addressing risks or plan deficits in their budget. So for this organization, again, taking a step back to what we talked a little bit about earlier in terms of assessing the likelihood and magnitude and kind of tagging numbers to this, they looked at a high likely event to occur within 3 years, a moderate event being possibly occurring within 3 years, and then a low event, having a remote chance to occur within 3 years. In terms of the magnitude, they set the high end of this at $1 million, and then they set the low end of something less than 500,000. And again, there's no right or wrong answer on how you scale this within your organization. Again, the idea is to just simply have something that is numeric and quantifiable, and again, defensible in terms of what your position would be to assess your reserves and kind of tag them with your risks. So again, as I talked a little bit about earlier, a lot of organizations are looking at reserves in two buckets. Again, as indicated at the top of this slide, this organization was looking at strategic opportunities first. And then kind of working from left to right, they identified the likelihood of these four items being moderate, and then the magnitude being high for the first item and then low for the next three items. Then we have a description of the opportunity. So they saw an opportunity to purchase a potential trade show that would help to provide continued values to their members, to add additional constituents to their kind of tax exempt purpose. And they saw a potential cost of this being $2 million out several years. Again, the second item was an educational offering. Again, that value-added proposition of growing what your offerings are and continuing to have your members and constituents engaged. The third item was around recruitment efforts. Again, they were principally a domestic-based organization, and they were looking to grow this internationally and were pontificating a sort of a membership call or a global expansion in a couple of years. So they looked at that as a possible growth opportunity. And then with some of these additional educational programs and additional recruiting, they saw that there was going to be the need for additional staff as well. So again, they tagged dollars to this, and you know, in this presentation, we don't have the time to go through how they came up with the numbers, but it was looking at historical costs. It was looking at what they thought, the number of staff would be for these efforts, and what would it look like to hire and to pay benefits to this staff. So there is some back effort and some backup behind these numbers, but again, it's on a projection-based process. Again, then they looked at risks, and you can see the risks here. Again, the same methodology, kind of moving from left to right. They're in the membership space, so they had increased lobbying efforts on Capitol Hill, so they saw some need for that pretty equitably over the next 3 years. They took a look at the risk of the decline in the investment portfolio because of moving markets and saw a risk there. Certainly IT risks, as we've mentioned several times, was the third item identified, and then industry consolidations and potentially loss of members due to member organizations combining. So again, they took a look at these risks and saw them as fairly equitable across the board for the preceding 3 years or succeeding 3 years, and came up with quantifiable metrics there. And again, all of these numbers were supported by additional data around what does it cost to lobby, what's an annual expenditure around lobbying, what's historical loss rates been in the market, what are increasing IT costs around cybersecurity. So they've got backup for these items as well in their analysis. So again, they took the the reserves that they had at the time of 6 million, and again, they were on a budget of about 10 million. They had an actual reserve ratio of 60%. Again, looking at the second kind of group of numbers there, they had their opportunities reserve of just over 3 million, the proposed risk reserve of 4.3 million to come to a combined reserve of just south of 7.4 million. So the conclusion here was their actual reserves were 6 million at the time. They wanted to have a targeted growth of 1.3 to 1.4 over the next 3 years to get to that 7.4 range. And again, this helps to provide context to board members, context to constituents around, perhaps why dues are increasing, while there's an additional drive for perhaps, additional revenue functions and things like that. And I should mention that when we talk about these reserve studies and we talk about looking at risks and opportunities, it's not done in a vacuum. It's not management coming up with these numbers and presenting it to the board. Yes, management is going to have the back office numbers. Yes, they're going to have the GL support and do a lot of the legwork. But the best reserve studies that I've worked on have been developed in collaboration and not in a silo. Some of the ones that I've worked on, yes, they start with management and they start with within the organization, including department heads, including those at the grassroots level around all of your additional or various revenue generating functions. Then it goes up to a committee and then ultimately the board. And it's not, here's our reserve projection, approve it. It's here's what we're proposing. Let's have a discussion. And I will say 3 out of 4 times the committee or the board come back and they tweak it and they modify it because their constituents, their governance, and oftentimes their members. And so they best know how they want the organization that they're leading to address some of these items. So again, it's very much a collaborative process versus a siloed approach. So again, just in the few minutes that we have left, wanted just to kind of wrap it up and sort of conclude. I think if you look at how we've presented today, again, there's certainly a number of risks out there in terms of technology, in terms of developing and meeting your constituent needs, certainly a loss of grant funding, as we're all well aware over the course of the last couple of weeks, and a number of financial considerations, certainly world and domestic events. So this is a continuous process. This is not a static process to look at and develop your reserve policy around risks and opportunities. I would say the best organizations that I've worked with, they come up with a reserve and they're constantly going back, they're looking at it, they're tweaking it when they need to. Events are moving at a rapid and ever-changing pace. And oftentimes your reserve needs to reflect that fluidity. Melissa mentioned earlier, whether you call it a risk management committee or whether you call it by another acronym or another name, making sure that you're involving governance and making sure you're involving everyone in your organization really in determining this is going to give you the best outcome. And then certainly making sure that whatever you've come up with in terms of risks and opportunities, you're aligning it with your long-term reserve position and thinking about those that would be in a short-term position and making sure the investments really reflect the nature and the constant level of risks that that come along with that. So again, Melissa and I were certainly happy to present to you today. We'd certainly like to thank everyone for attending our event. We're going to continue to do various iterations of this and continue to have various dialogues around risks and around reserves and present different seminars around this topic. So please continue to follow us on social media at GRF CPAs. Certainly visit our website for upcoming additional content. Always reach out to us. Our email's here at the bottom if there's anything we can do for you in this space or any other space. And remember to complete the survey that will automatically appear to earn your CPE. So again, on behalf of Melissa, thank you very much for your time and attention. And we wish everyone a pleasant afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the GRF On The Go podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.